Good day, everyone. Participation in this call is by express written invitation of the AAJ only. Unauthorized participants and or any party that aids and abets such unauthorized participants may be subject to criminal and civil penalties under both state and federal law, including the Electronic Communication Privacy Act. Welcome to the American Hospital Association Strategies to Address Violence in Post-Acute Environments conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. However, the Q&A session at the end of the conference will not be recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Ms. Shauna Brown. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you. Hello, and thank you all for joining us today and participating on our Strategies for Addressing Violence in Post-Acute Environments webinar, one of the Section's 2016 Members-Only Best Practice Series. As you know, recent reports are showing that workplace violence has increased significantly in healthcare, and as the number of violent acts within our communities continues to grow, we are challenged to find solutions to manage and reduce patient and family violence, as well as violence against healthcare professionals in post-acute care. The American Hospital Association Section for Long-Term Care and Rehabilitation is excited to host today's webinar, featuring two of your colleagues, Dr. Michelle Gidler, Medical Director for Schwab Rehabilitation Hospital, located in the heart of the inner city, and Ken Bowman, CEO of Van Meter Health South Rehabilitation Hospital in Rockford, Illinois, a large neighboring city.
Today they will share successful strategies developed to assist in providing health care to patients who have violently acquired injuries, including issues of trust, drug abuse, substance abuse, and lack of community-based services and family support, as well as examples of staff education, initiatives, and peer mentoring programs. Also, some unique administrative controls and workplace practices, including post-event analysis and caregiver treatments. And lastly, suggestions for community initiatives and collaborative efforts to address the increase in violence within a community. After their presentations, our panelists will respond to the questions that you've submitted online or call in through the operator. You're also encouraged to share ideas and strategies that have been successful in your own communities to address violent prevention in healthcare environments. You should have received a PDF of the presentation that's posted online today, along with the brief bios for both speakers, either in an email confirmation that was sent to you either yesterday or today. And at this time, I'd like to turn the call over to Dr. Gidler to kick us off.
Thank you. My name is Michelle Gidler. I'm a rehabilitation physician, and I work at the Schwab Rehabilitation Hospital. I've been here for 24 years. I'm going to discuss, in particular, some programs that we've developed based on our work with individuals who have violently acquired injuries as the etiology of their disability. Here at Schwab, we've started developing these programs that we felt were critical to the rehabilitation process because individuals who have violently acquired injuries have a series of other comorbidities that may be more psychosocial, but that are going to be important to their successful rehabilitation. Schwab is located on the west side of Chicago in a community called North Lawndale. The patient population that we serve is 90% African American and Latino. Many of the individuals that we serve have poor social determinants of health, and those include things like unstable housing, low income, they live in unsafe neighborhoods, they have substandard education. And then finally, just to set the stage, over 60% of our patients receive Medicaid benefits. So we developed programs with several different names. The first is our umbrella department that we call the Extended Services Department. The Extended Services Department is beyond occupational and physical therapy or rehabilitation psychology. We started this program in the late 90s when many of you may recall there was an uptick in the number of violently acquired injuries in some of our big cities with very high homicide rates. We formally made this a department in 2001. And the thing that's unique about this is that most of the people that staff our programs are individuals not only who have sustained a disability, but most of them either have a violently acquired injury or were engaged in activities that predisposed them to violence. The first program is called In My Shoes, and many of you may have heard of this. This was a program started in the late 90s. And it's a peer-led violence prevention intervention. As I said, the people that lead this program are former patients that have either sustained violently acquired injuries as victims or they've been perpetrators of street violence. You can't see me, but I'm a middle-aged white lady. And my credibility is not going to be as strong as having a peer meet with at-risk youth to talk about the risk factors related to intentional violence. In addition to talking about risk factors, woven into this are discussions about conflict resolution and anger management. Our peer mentors do go through a program where they learn how to speak. And one of the biggest challenges for us, and maybe for you, is that when we are hiring individuals who perhaps have records, it's something that you have to go through your hospital with because hiring an individual who has an incarceration record can be problematic. The In My Shoes program is targeted primarily at youth and young adults. Some of them are already offenders that are involved in the juvenile justice system, and some of them are individuals who are felt to be at risk either by their school social workers or by other social agencies that have identified that they need help. Our challenge is that this was all grant-funded. And most of our grant funding, as I'm sure many of you can feel, has dried up since about 2010. So we continue to work on trying to get more grant funding for this because we believe it was a really successful program. Some of the feedback we got from the youth that we worked with, and the reason we work with these youth, of course, is to prevent them from sustaining a violently acquired injury or from going down a difficult path, is first their recognition that individuals with disabilities are the exact same as they are. It's just that they don't have the same mobility. They've also shared some of their stories, which are really quite poignant, about having been shot at before, having seen people shot, or perhaps having to have sustained their own non-disabling gunshot wound. I found most interesting that many of them were then also able to discuss how joining a gang was not a good thing. There's a lot of peer pressure to join gangs, particularly in the neighborhoods of Chicago and other of our urban areas. But just to get them to reflect that when you do this, it's not always a good thing or necessarily a good thing, in particular understanding that while you may join for protection, your fellow gang members won't protect you. They discussed making good choices, and I think if we can get our youth to focus on thinking about the choices that they make and understanding that the choices that they make have consequences, that is a huge leap to versus having individuals sort of blindly following a path. And then finally, the appreciation for others with disabilities, as well as the admiration for the speakers, was good for the participants, but it was great for our peers who felt valued in spite of their disability. We also have a peer mentoring program. And this program was started to meet the needs of our youth who had sustained violently acquired spinal cord injuries. What we did was we identified patients who were people that could interact well with other individuals and who expressed an interest in this program. And we set up a training for them, so they went through a multi-hour peer training or peer mentoring program, discussed how you talk to people, how you don't talk to people, but it also established guidelines for how you show up to a job, how you dress, and how you have to apply for jobs. Peer mentors are then matched up with mentees, and the goal would be for the peer mentor to meet up with the mentee before discharge from the rehabilitation hospital and then follow them longitudinally, sometimes for as long as up to 2 years, to help them navigate this strange new world, which they knew well when they were able-bodied, but which is far more complicated with the disability. Things that the peer mentors were able to help their mentees do include things like enrolling in college, obtaining hand controls, which was really important, understanding how to get their home ramped, understanding how to advocate for themselves so that they could get either bathroom equipment or bathroom modification in their homes. So I picked this comment as something that's so, to me, so poignant and yet so important to our patients. So a number of our individuals with spinal cord injuries, of course, have intermittent bowel and bladder incontinence. And the one mentee who said, I like being in the program because my mentor helped me get the numbers for community services and assistance on how to find diapers. This may seem trivial, but it was such a big deal for him because then he could go out into the community and try to reengage. We did start a peer mentoring program for individuals who sustained brain injury. We proposed this and got some funding for it in 2007, and in 2008, we hired and trained two mentors. We only have two mentors, and we replace them as funding allows. You can imagine that peer mentoring for individuals with a brain injury is a little bit more complex than a spinal cord injury. In many regards, it's as much for the patient's family as it is for the patient. So when they see somebody walking in who sustained a brain injury and can discuss their journey, can discuss issues related to substance abuse, which often is a predisposer for brain injury, can discuss issues related to self-care and some things related to anger and outbursts, it's been quite helpful. Finally, the one aspect related to individuals who've sustained violently acquired injury is assisting them in completing their education, whether it's a GED or going to high school or moving on, and employment. And we know that individuals with disabilities have higher rates of unemployment. Individuals with violently acquired disabilities have even higher rates of unemployment, in part because of their substandard education. So in part to that end, we also created a disability resource center. And this is, it's just a room that has a bunch of clear shelving on the walls. And what we do is we collect information that's specific to our communities, information in Spanish and in English, that looks at issues like where you can go to get assistance for accessible housing, transportation, how you navigate your managed care, how you look at what's available in terms of employment or employment opportunities, how to advocate for yourself when you have a personal care attendant. So we have the information there, and we have informal mentoring there. So we'll have some of our prior patients volunteer to be in there and say, this is how I navigated it. And sometimes just being handheld, if you will, while someone's on the phone is quite reassuring. We also have a community technology center. It's a computer lab. The computers were donated. And we have this lab open to individuals on the west side. Many of our patients have smartphones, but many of them don't have computers. And what we try to do is give people the opportunity to come in and learn basic computer skills. Some of those skills include things like learning how to do a Word document. They include learning how to look up employment opportunities. And for many of our patients, it also helps them learn how to access online communities. So in addition to some regular course curricula, and that would be like learning how to do a Word document, we will have our volunteers, mostly individuals who have sustained a disability, demonstrate for people how to do a resume, how to interview, how to apply to some City of Chicago classes, and then we also keep a career interest inventory. So the last thing I want to talk about, in addition to the Extended Services Program, is how we create a similar program, but how we create parity in rehab. And a lot of times, you know, we look at individuals with a violently acquired injury, and already we give them a black mark. Surely they did something wrong to have sustained a violently acquired injury. So, you know, what our Extended Services Program does is we have a safe environment, it's accessible, our staff is culturally competent, not just meaning they might speak Spanish or not, but they understand the risks in the community. People also see that someone with a disability can be employed. And creating similar programs, I think, includes asking your staff what the needs of the population might be, listening to your patients. Funding is, of course, the F word, and we can go into that later. But creating buy-in from your administration, or if you're an administrator, giving buy-in, that this is important. And then finally, you know, when we talk about individuals with violently acquired injuries, you know, it's not all rainbows and unicorns, right? Some people have done some difficult things. But what we have to do is say, all right, our institution is setting basic rules for anybody in the institution, not just someone with a violently acquired injury. That these basic rules are in place so everybody can get better at the same rate, enjoy the opportunity to be in rehabilitation, and to know what is and is not tolerated. So these are some of the rules that we have at Schwab. And when I say they're followed by everybody, you don't want to just give these to individuals who've been shot, right? This needs to be across the board so that all staff know that what is tolerated and what is not. So these are the things that are grounds for removal from our post-acute setting. Disorderly conduct, whether it's by the patient or the family that is disruptive to other patients or families. Threatening anyone at any time. Possession of or exchanging drugs and possession of a firearm in the building. So these are, in our community, the guidelines that we came up with together with our staff, and I would just encourage everyone else to meet with their staff, have their guidelines, and, you know, it's not judgmental. This is just the rule, kind of like when I was growing up with my dad. There's some things you do and some things you don't do. So I'm going to turn it over now to Ken.
Thank you very much. And I would like to share with you some of the things that we are currently doing at Van Meter Health South Rehabilitation Hospital in Rockford to develop strategies to eliminate or identify the risk of hazards or potential violence in our hospital, and also share the violence prevention white paper that was developed by the Violence Prevention Task Force of Health South. I recently presented key points of the white paper at the Post-Acute Care, AHA Post-Acute Care Council. It was well received, and I would like to share some of those key points here today in the short amount of time that we have. But I just want to let you know the white paper is posted to the AHA website for anyone to review. And as you will see as I go through it, I have some key key things that each hospital or post-acute or any healthcare setting, recommendations that we should be working on, or anyone should be working on at any point in time. So let's talk about Rockford in general. Right outside of a suburb of Chicago, it's an hour away. It's Illinois' second largest city. Most people don't know where we are. People talk about Chicago all the time. Whenever you say you're from Illinois, everyone wants to know if you're from Chicago. But Rockford is a growing community, and we're seeing urban sprawl. And like any community, any large community, we're seeing the effects of social ills, and we're seeing more and more violent episodes within the community. We're experiencing more incidences within the hospital, mainly verbal abuse that happens between family members and things that staff have to intercede on. It's becoming a little bit more prevalent. So American Nursing Association had surveyed about 3,700 nurses in 2014, and they had identified that 21% of those registered nurses and students had reported having a physical assault of some kind, and 50% of those had been verbally abused, which is a very large number, 21%. And then the Emergency Nursing Association did a similar survey, and they noticed that 12% of the emergency room department nurses had experienced some physical violence, with 59% having some verbal abuse. And if you just noticed from Dr. Gittler's presentation from her last slide, SWAB has set some standards on identifying what is acceptable and not acceptable, which many of us are doing and so forth, and seeing some of the things that SWAB has done and some of the things that I'm going to go over right now should lead us to some ways that staff should be aware of and their role in protecting the environment for our patients, visitors, and other staff members. So the Joint Commission has also identified that the violence in healthcare and within every setting is also increasing. So you would think, why are we talking about this now? Because with so many episodes of violence being reported, it is important that healthcare facilities have a violence prevention strategy or plan in place to protect not only their patients and visitors, but their staff as well, and how to address these issues with staff. And not only from the physical or emotional side, but how to address and mitigate any potential harms within the workplace. So this slide that I have here is just to show that Rockford, while it's a large metropolitan city, Rockford is ranked fifth in the safest cities in America, in the United States, meaning that there are 95% of the cities safer than Rockford. So to that end, Illinois is one of those states that requires that we have that healthcare facilities have a workplace violence prevention plan in place. California, Connecticut, Maryland, New Jersey, and Oregon are other states that require violence prevention plans, and I'm sure many more states will begin to require it as well. So what are we doing at Van Meter specifically? Well, within our code whites, our code silver policies, we are also ensuring that we have policies or disruptive behavior education around how to coordinate an effective emergency response plan, how to report active threats surrounding a hospital, internally or externally, and how to educate staff and how to report any incidences of violence and to deal with disruptive behaviors of patients, visitors, or even other employees. And one of those that we've put a huge investment in is our CPI training. And I know many organizations use this, but this is a huge investment. CPI is initially is an 8-hour certification course for all clinical staff and 4 hours of training every year thereafter. And it is a huge investment, but it is a necessary investment because the methods that are being taught through the CPI training is to be able to develop a respectful work environment, to use de-escalation techniques for non-physical crisis intervention, and to allow staff to have the confidence in being able to address situations as they begin to escalate, regardless of who is the escalator and so forth. Some of the other things that we're doing at Van Meter is our partnership with acute care hospitals and other post-acute organizations around us. That not only do we participate in our in annual drills with these for pandemics, but we're also participating in drills with them on massive community adverse event situations. Unfortunately, we just had one about 3 weekends ago where this plan truly had to be implemented. And yes, we were the recipients of some of those individuals. And it always comes out from staff during our conversations about the patients that we have met, is the building safe? And you want to always ensure that, that the building is safe and so forth. And that's the impetus for developing these plans to ensure that, that staff is comfortable with the interventions that the organization is putting in place. One of the other things, our sponsorship of a community violence prevention workshop with the Rockford Community Council, addressing not only violence in the community, but addressing the aftermath of violence and dealing with staff level of anxiety around violence. And we are continuing to sponsor these types of workshops as we continue to see these the need in our community. And then our partnership with local law enforcement. From time to time, we partner with law enforcement to review our policies, walk through our building, to see that we are appropriately writing policies that are appropriate for our building community, that they know in the midst of an evacuation, where is our safe zone external to the building, and so forth. So that partnership is monumental, and we'll talk about that in just a moment again within this white paper. But within the white paper, I was fortunate to be able to present this at the Post-Acute Care Council. The individuals that contributed on this paper from the Violence Prevention Task Force is an array of individuals throughout HealthSouth. HealthSouth is comprised of 125 hospitals and Encompass Home Health, that individuals from those organizations throughout the country, from the National Director of Risk, who was the chair, CEOs, plan op directors, and so forth, came up with a really robust, very robust document that I recommend that you go to the AHA website. As you develop your plans for mitigating violence and understanding risk, how to report, how to document, and how to come up with safety, I would recommend that you visit and take a moment to review some of the recommendations from this task force. But I'm going to walk you through just a few of these recommendations. Well, within this white paper, the OSHA recommended and suggested that all employers establish a workplace violence that, if they do so, that has at least addressed the management's commitment and employee involvement. Employee involvement is monumental. Assessment and analysis of the workplace security and hazards, prevention and controls, training on how to prevent these hazards, and lastly, to evaluate the plan. And again, certain states require that you have these in place, Illinois being one of those states. The purpose for developing this white paper and why the task force was convened was that HealthSouth wanted hospitals to recognize the frequency and severity of workplace violence. Something happened to my slides here. So the purpose for developing the paper was for HealthSouth to recognize the frequency and severity of workplace violence in healthcare, and to identify the risk and episodes within a healthcare setting, and to provide recommendations for how any workplace violence prevention plan can be a useful tool or roadmap for individual settings, no matter where they are located geographically. While being outside of Chicago and we are experiencing an increase in episodes, this violence prevention plan can work within many of our communities. So looking at some of management's commitment that we just talked about just a moment ago, again, OSHA recommends that management leads the initiative and task force, that gets staff involved and have a true demonstration of their commitment by allocating resources and time to develop these plans and ensuring that the amount of the right resources and interventions are put in place to ensure that there's a safe and effective workplace for our patients, visitors, and staff. And understanding that employees that drive these plans have the time and also the commitment for developing a robust plan that address the effects of violence in any program. Looking at the assessment tools, and it is recommended that workplace violence risk assessment tools should be completed at least annually to review your plan that is strong enough to identify where the organization may be vulnerable for any workplace violence episode that have the potential of occurring. Reviewing your plan helps eliminate or mitigate some of the incidents that could occur and allow the committees and employees to develop strategies for implementing improvement techniques for their particular setting. Some of the prevention strategies that have been developed are to ensure that some of the things that we already know, that places are well lit, ensuring that there's lightings or timers, especially with the change in time now because of daylight savings, ensure that there's panic buttons around the brain injury units or certain high volume units that are seeing an increase in violence, that key cards are being used whenever necessary. And some of the ones that we typically don't think about is ensuring that even our vendors sign in. As much as we see some of the same people consistently that deliver the food, nutrition, medications, and other patient care supplies and anything else, they too should sign in so we have an understanding of who's in the building at any one time to ensure that it is appropriate and safe. Looking at some of the training that must occur, the training program should involve all employees, including supervisors and managers, and even those individuals that are new to the organization, those that are visiting the organization, such as physicians that just come and go with no real frequency, should also be aware of the violence prevention plan that the task forces or your individual staff have developed, to ensure that when any episode arises, who are the go-tos? What are the safe areas in the building? How do we begin to mitigate or to de-escalate any situation before it turns into an awful situation? The workplace violence prevention policy should drive some of those strategies. But looking at risk factors that cause or contribute to assault in the workplace should also be in the training program. Ways to deal with the hostile people and other patients and clients and visitors, how to deal with those individuals while they're going through traumatic situations of their own and they escalate. And lastly, on training, developing a buddy system, ways to protect ourselves and coworkers, including a buddy system that look for one, look for individuals to make sure that your coworkers are absolutely safe is very important. And then evaluation of our plans, evaluating the plans to ensure that they are effective. The training program should also include at least that evaluation process that includes things like, have you looked at your bomb threat programs, threats of violence, and weapons in your building and so forth within your hospital. And lastly, building that community alliance. I have to just stress this once again because we participate so heavily in our community and addressing violence, and in just recently over the last year, that it is very important to have this alliance with law enforcement so that they are acutely aware of your building, your policies, and the things that are going on in your particular hospital. So there's so many other things that are addressed in the violence prevention white paper. There's tools on how to do risk assessments. There's tools on how to educate staff, how to the framework to developing effective policies, doing annual evaluation, reporting violence, risk mitigation, and so forth. The task force that developed the white paper has done such a robust job in giving All Health South and Encompass Home Health these frameworks to build a robust violence prevention, whether it's required in your state or not, but to ensure that our environments are conducive for providing a healing environment, even under the stressful advent of looming adverse events and so forth, and giving staff the confidence that leadership is involved in ensuring that they have a safe environment by their true commitment to allocating the resources. So again, if you have an opportunity, definitely go to the AHA website and pull down the paper. It is more than 100 pages of useful recommendations that can be tailored to any setting, post-acute or home health. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Operator, would you give the instructions for Q&A?